Welcome to the Admin Admin Podcast, the podcast for people working in the real world of IT. If you're a sysadmin, working on the help desk, a network engineer, an IT consultant, computer techie wants to know more about servers, or even if you want to get a job in the IT field, this podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Al.
And I'm Andy. And this is a bit of a landmark for us, isn't it? Because we're up to episode 10.
Woohoo.
Let's have a yay. Anyway, something special, something different for this episode. We have a guest join us, don't we? So I'd like to introduce yourself.
Hello, I'm Jerry. Nice to meet everyone. Hello, listeners.
Hello. Yes, so me and Jerry met at Ogcamp a couple of weeks ago. We met in a bar. That sounds really quite...
It wasn't like that, although you did buy me a drink.
Yeah. So we basically just, it's my first Ogcamp, didn't know anyone, and it was Jerry's first Ogcamp, and he didn't know anyone either, so we just started talking to each other, so you're a Linux system admin, aren't you, for your...
I am, for my sins, over 10 years now, so... Yeah, I sort of know my way around the Linux box, you might say.
Yes, that's why I wanted to get him on the show, because I'm always looking out to get some Linux help out. That's what some of our listeners might be interested in it as well. So what have you been up to, Andy? Anything interesting?
Well, this week has been half term, hasn't it, in most of England.
Yes.
Some of them may have a different week, but I've had a couple of days off this week because of half term and that. So, not that many stories on the job front. I've had a few virus removals that I've had to do, and so I used D7 for most of them. Mm-hmm. It's proven pretty good. Definitely a big time saver. To run it because there's so much automation in it. It really kind of. Just allows you to get a load of stuff done without looking at it. You can just set it to deleting this or searching for that and things like that, and just basically walk away from it. And when you get back to it, it's done. It does 99% or maybe a bit less than that of what you need. They're all automated. There's just a couple of programs that it runs that you do need to accept or click the next button or whatever.
Okay.
But that's been running really, really well this week. I also had a job with someone who, I basically spent the day with him because they have some kind of practice over in a very posh area around here, and he wanted to get his. This is his words. He wanted to get his online presence back up there again because it was a bit out of date and a bit untidy. So I was thinking, what are we going to do for this? I was thinking, what SEO strategies or marketing strategies he's going to do. I basically spent the entire day at his place. All he wanted doing was updating the picture on his Google Plus page. Updating the cover photo, set up a LinkedIn account, updated his Twitter account, and that was it.
Right.
So I had all these kind of plans, and he didn't really want to do any of them.
Yeah.
But okay. I mean, I didn't mind. It was a day's work, and it was pretty easy, really, to be honest.
Good day, easy work. I was going to ask, about spyware? I got given a laptop today off one of my close family, and you reckon it's got, I haven't booted up yet, it's got some pop-ups or something. What is the best thing? Are we still talking about malware bytes? Are you best to run that first, or what would you do to go your process?
Okay, so there's a lot of generic sort of pop-ups and stuff like that. Some of them are very hidden, some of them are just running as a plug-in in the likes of Google Chrome or in Firefox, or an add-on. So it's always worth checking the add-ons or the plugins first. occasionally some of them change, if it's on a Windows box, some of them change the now if you go into network configurations,
yeah,
and you can change the proxy settings.
Yeah.
Some viruses actually change the proxy to another address, mm-hmm. Which you get a lot of pop-ups from. Otherwise, if it's something that's affected on the machine, first thing I would do is just look through add remove programs to see if there's any obvious unwanted junkware on there. I'd also delete all the temp directories, including the temp directories and all the user profiles, because a lot of them hide in there. And in terms of programs you could run, yeah, Malwarebytes is one of them. And another two good one is JRT, Junkware Removal Tool. You can get that from bleeping.com.
Yeah.
And ADW Cleaner as well.
Mm-hmm.
The combination of running those three. Oh, and the Malwarebytes has also got an anti-rootkit version as well. A combination of running those four usually gets 99% of them.
Okay.
So they're definitely all worth running.
I mean, just looking at that from my point of view, I've been given a couple of laptops by friends that need sorting out, and I would say this being a Linux guy, but I've put Ubuntu on them, and the users have been perfectly happy. So, if they need the Windows software, then sure, you can go down that route. But, in these cases, they didn't have the original Windows disks or anything. I didn't have a license copy or anything. So I just thought, quick and easy solution, stick Linux on it. And desktop Linux is at such a stage now where you can do that for most users.
Oh, yeah. I've had a few customers who've, when I explain to them, initially they're scared of it. For most users are scared of the word Linux, because they don't know, they haven't got a clue, and maybe in years gone by, is a lot more complex, should you say, than it is now.
Yeah, it's definitely
a lot more user friendly. Yeah.
Yeah, you can just sort of chuck it on a laptop and it just works pretty much for 95% of the people that what they do on a computer,
But if you think about it, if they want to do is go on the internet, they want to have documents or whatever, then that just about covers everything, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You know, they even put the music on it and the pictures on it.
So one of my acquaintances went into use BitTorrent, so, and there's a quite a nice BitTorrent client. And there has been, there's quite a few to choose from in Linux as well, so he was happy.
Yeah, that's it. And just with a bit of tuition, if you don't understand it. But once you get to a desktop, especially in the likes of Ubuntu, once you get to the desktop, you show them. It's a bit like showing someone a Mac for the first time. They look at it and they go, what do we do with this? But when you show them various basics to get going, they understand it. And once they bring up a web browser and it says Google on the top with a box underneath, they understand that completely. It's irrelevant whether it's Linux or whether it's Mac or Windows. They just understand it.
That's what a Chromebook is, really, isn't it? It's just a little laptop running Linux, and the browser is everything, pretty much.
Yeah, luckily this person uses Photoshop. He does printing out photos on canvases. I haven't had the managed to put anyone onto Linux yet on the desktop. I still don't feel like I can support it yet, kind of thing.
It's purely for mates, so really. But and in fact, one of them even went so far as to put a Linux printer driver on her laptop. Mm-hmm. She actually downloaded the driver and followed the instructions.
Wow.
And managed to get it working. It's amazing. It's all command line as well,
Well, I might be messaging this week there, Andy, if I get any issues with this laptop. But I think I'm hoping to be able to run those four programs and see which one removes it. So,
Some of them could do it. I could remote it on if it needs to.
Yeah. Okay, well, I've been working with D-Deep stuff this week. Well, I've been off this week as well because it's half term as well. But the week before I was doing, you know, I was talking about all these massive backup servers I've been doing with backing up all these virtual machines. Well, half this problem is that you want to D-Deep in because they want to keep their backups for quite a long time. So every week they have got a 3 terabyte backup file of all their virtual machines. And obviously weekly there's not much data change, but they want to have a separate file for each week. So I've been setting up with Windows 2012 is this D-Deep feature, which is basically means that it looks at a file. So if it compares two files, and if it sees something the same, it kind of like it hashes it so that it saves the space. So it only writes the data to the disk once. So that's been quite interesting. There's a couple of limitations on that in case people want to do that. Is that only supports up a volume up to 64 terabytes. So if you got anything bigger drives than that, or your bigger RAID set than that, that's you can't. Doing you can't have any more than that. And also, if you're dealing with files over 1 terabyte, which I am, you need to format the drive with a /L command. I'll put the command in the show notes. But because there's a problem with defragmentation of terabyte, that's over a file, which is over a terabyte. So that's why you have to format it in this /L, and that basically puts it so that it doesn't get defragged. So that means you can have.
Oh, is that what right? I was going to say what the L switch command was for. What does it mean? What does the L mean?
It means larger. I think it means it's larger bits. So I think the 64K bits it saved, or per sect. I think it puts a bigger one in so that it gets past its 1 terabyte limit. So that's been interesting about that. So also got 2 board podcasts I want people to listen to. One is like a little short, like 10 minutes one, a lady called Teresa Hummel, called the Itty Bitty Security Podcast. And she does a little 10-minute podcast every week about things like SSL, Facebook security, Google Plus security, backup into cloud ideas and stuff. It's always quite a little interesting just to listen to. And even if you want to give it to your friends and family, it's quite basic kind of thing, but it does get people thinking about things.
That's a good idea. Yeah, that sounds pretty good. You'll have to put that in the show notes as well if you can.
It makes an alternative to I don't know if you listen to Steve Gibson Security Now on the Twitter network. Yeah. It's great. It's really really informative and everything, but it's generally 2 hours long, so a 10-minute cut down version sounds good.
Yeah, it's not. Yeah, sometimes Steve goes over my head. I go, what is he going on about now? Kind of thing.
Yeah.
And the other one I've listened to is called My Hard Drive Died, or My Hard Drive Died.
And that's back again, isn't it?
It's on the Podnuts Network. It's really good. Anyone should listen to that. It's a guy called Scott Moulton, and he runs a data recovery company in America and a forensics company. And he tells you how he kind of does always. Recovers hard drives, what have failed and stuff. And like last week he was talking about RAID sets and how to recover RAID sets and stuff. So that's another good podcast.
I used to like that one as well. I mean, that was running until recently. It hadn't been on there for about a year or so.
No, I found it when I first found the Podnuts Network, and then it went quiet. And now Jeff has come back the last 2 episodes, and it's definitely...
It's been 2, hasn't it? I've listened to 1, and I know there's been once. Since then, it was the last one I listened to. We was talking about the legal side of forensics and things like that, and what private investigators could do, because effectively he's a kind of private investigator in that form, isn't he?
Yes,
he's investigating hard drives for evidence. So that was quite interesting. It was all to do with what you could do in different states and stuff like that. I think that was more of a legal side of it, that particular podcast.
Yeah, this one's more technical and talking about RAID 5 sets and how they work and how they recover and what you should do if you have a RAID set fail. But he's also got a lot of good videos on YouTube you can watch, what kind of like he's done at Ofcom and stuff. So definitely guys to check that out, really. So
I've done a couple of data recovery things. The only thing I can really do is if the drive is mechanically okay, Yeah, I've used some. I have some software that I paid for it years ago. Called Get Back. I think it's called by Runtime Software. I think it is. And this is the kind of software you can actually format the drive.
Yeah.
So you can have a hard drive with data on, and you can format it, reinstall Windows, run Get Back, and then get all the data that was on it before you formatted it.
Mm-hmm.
Very clever.
It's only Linux tools there, Jerry, which you can use to. Have you done anything like that to recover stuff? Or?
Not that I know of. I was just going to bring up Steve Gibson again, because he's obviously got SpinWrite, which he talks about most episodes. I don't know if you guys have ever tried that.
Yeah, I've used it a couple of times. It saved a couple of drives. I had one the other month where it scanned. When they were watching iPlayer on their laptop, it was like it was juttering every 30 seconds, and I ran everything on the hard drive, did a defrag and checked everything was working fine. In the end, I had to take the drive out of the machine because the SpinWrite wouldn't see the disk, and I put it into another machine. It took 24 hours. I did a full scan, and after that, the laptop flew. It like booted up like in half the time, and then when it did the iPlayer thing, it was fine. No jittering at all. So yeah,
and that's a very long process to run it. So I don't know if you'd use that as a last resort or, but I mean, essentially, do you know or do any of you know how it works or what it does?
It flips the bits. I think it reads.
Flips the bits. That's the quote.
I think Steve's got a working knowledge of every single hard drive technology there is, and knows exactly how it works, and can write. And he writes in an assembler, doesn't he? So really low level, system calls. So
How does it fare with? Do the drives have to be mechanically sound?
I think it. Don't quote me on this, but I think what it does is it. You know when you get read errors on your Windows gets read errors or whatever. Mm-hmm. Or it only tries a certain amount of times and then it marks it bad or something. And what this does, using the smart technology, I think when you boot up SpinWrite, it ignores that spark thing and it will just keep trying and trying and trying again until it will get that bit back. So it reads every sector. I think it reads, depending on what it does, there's like different modes, isn't there, I think.
Mm.
And one of the modes is it will just read all the bits to make sure that everything is right. But like when I did it, basically reads a bit, put it into memory, and then moves it. I don't think it moves it somewhere else. It basically reads it and then writes it again somehow, or it erases it and then writes it back. So it makes sure it basically puts every part of the hard drive. And if it finds a bad bit, I think it then marks it bad for good, so it can't be used. Don't quote me on it, but it seems to work my time to get this hard drive faster, kind of thing. So,
I remember something similar in kind of Windows 95 days, and I can't remember what it was called.
SpinWrite's been out for years, hasn't it? It's been out for it's version 6 now. I think it's been out since like MS-DOS or whatever. So it could be the same product.
It must be a lot. Does it depend on how much data's on your drive, or how big the drive is?
It's basically a boot disk. So you boot it off the CD.
Yeah.
And it goes off and looks at the files, the hard drive as a whole. It doesn't even look at the file system, I don't think. It looks at, you can do it on Mac and Linux disks. So
that's completely irrelevant. All it's interested in is the zeros and ones.
Yeah.
That's right,
This guy knows his stuff about hard drives, though. So.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, you can when you listen to him. I mean, he goes all around the world, doesn't he, doing these conferences and these...
Well, there's the Steve Gibson guy I was talking about.
Sorry,
But, no. Cool.
Yeah, I mean, from my point of view, working with data and so on, I'm either working with massive RAID arrays where, if an array fails, the software tells you, and then you swap out the disk and send it off, or it's hosted servers... where another company is responsible for all that. So luckily, I haven't had to deal with much of that. So I count myself quite lucky. I don't know. I mean, the only Linux tools I know of is there's Smart Tools. It's actually called Smart Mon Tools or something, which talks to the smart whatever that is on the disk.
Yeah.
So you know, it knows when it's about to fail, or it knows when something funny's going on, and alerts you. And then you can hook that into monitoring systems and so on.
Yeah, you can use I've used DD in the past, which is like a Linux command, isn't it, to copy bad disks. And that will basically, because the problem you get is if you try and copy a file or something, if it's got bad section, it won't copy it, will it?
But I think because it's going through the file system, but DD just does literally bit for bit, you know, copy this bit to here,
yeah,
and this bit to here, and so on.
There is something called PhotoRec. I never use. I know Martin from the Geeks has mentioned it, but I think that's I'll put that in the show notes, but that's quite interesting. I think that might kind of does the same sort of thing where it recovers stuff from disks and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, so Jerry, you talk about that, so do you want to tell a little bit more about yourself then, and what, so listeners know who you are and what you do?
Well, Linux admin. a lot of it is bespoke application support. And the other chunk of it is supporting web servers, so mainly Linux, Apache, MySQL, PHP type servers, and also email servers. So it tends to be web developers that host their websites on these servers, and also run email off there as well for their clients. Just keeping those running.
So do you have to? So do you go to work, or
I do a bit of both. But,
we'll get into the remote at the minute. You know.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I mean, all the web stuff I do remotely, because it has to be. But Linux is kind of built for that. You know, pretty much everything is done through a command line. It can seem a bit intimidating to begin with, but it's not really once you get used to it. And generally, you find with Linux, anything that needs a GUI, it starts. It either starts its own web server, or it has like a web interface for you to, you know, to be a bit more of a friendly interface, I suppose, in the command line.
I've wanted to get into Linux a lot more because to me it seems more of a computer guy's computer system.
Geeky.
Yeah. Yeah, it is, yeah, it's much more geeky, you know, to be able to say, hey, look what I can do. I can copy files from here to here by typing this in. You know, it's much more geeky than just drag and drop, you know?
I don't know. I mean, I find that you guys know a lot more, it seems to be, you know, a lot more about your, you know, your Windows stuff, right? You know, it's things like licensing and things like that. I mean, lucky Linux guys don't have to worry about that a lot of the time. It's just it's different, but I don't know. I started out as a Windows support guy, so I know that side of things, although I wasn't really doing much server stuff.
So do you run or work on Linux servers, as in equivalent to Server 2012, for example?
A lot of the, I mean, in my, well, I say in my day job, the business IT side of it, as they call it, is all Windows. So,
okay.
Email is Windows, and Active Directory and so on. And really the Linux machines are the, they run the apps that the company uses and do the sort of data processing. So, and that's always been done in Unix, whether it's Linux or you know, HP, UX or Sun. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of just kind of evolved to Linux because you can use commodity hardware, because a lot of these Unixes were made by the vendors of these, like Sun or HP, to run on their systems. So that's why the software is kind of gone through the ages, as it were. So a lot of the software is decades old. So,
So what OS, what distribution are you using it on your work servers then? So
work servers, it's Debian. It used to be, all I'll say is it used to be Red Hat and it isn't anymore. so it's now Debian. But Debian's kind of the hardcore Linux OS, but it's not really. Once you get to know it, it's quite friendly.
So I understand, are you running Wheezy then or whatever, the stable version or?
Actually, Squeeze, which is the old, I think it's called Old Stable now. It's changed recently. So with Debian, maybe I should explain for listeners, it's all named after Toy Story characters. And so the current one is Wheezy, the old one is Squeeze, the next one is Jesse. And there's always that, it goes, they've got the concept of old stable, stable and testing and unstable. And the unstable one is always called Sid, which is the kid from the first Toy Story who made all those weird toys.
Windows should do that. We were talking last time.
They've got interesting code names, haven't they? I mean, I listen to Windows Weekly podcast, and Mary Jo Foley is always, she has got a code name bingo, doesn't she? Where she, you know, it's like Windows 95 is called Chicago. I think it should have been called Chicago anyway, shouldn't it? Much better name than Windows 95.
That's it, cool, isn't it? Maybe we could call it, like, characters from Shrek or something. I mean, that'd be much more amusing, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Windows Shrek.
Yeah. Donkey. Windows Donkey.
Windows Donkey. Well, that was Vista.
Yeah.
Windows ME.
Yeah.
Okay. That's quite cool. So what happens if you get a problem in it which you can't fix then? With Debian, can you get paid support for Debian or not? Or is it really when it really hits a fan kind of thing? So
not Debian, although I assume there are companies that you can pay to support Debian.
Yeah.
But generally, Google.
Yeah.
You know, you can. I mean, that's the useful thing. You often get an error message. Talking about troubleshooting, I mean, the first place you often go to is the logs. Obviously, you have to find out where that log is, but there's generally a log. Apps will be writing out to a log, and there'll be useful information in there. Mm-hmm. And it's generally a case of Googling what you see in the log when something isn't working. And you sort of get to know your way around different logs and what they're telling you. And you can even, you know, look out for things. And if you've got monitoring software set up,
yeah,
you can look out for interesting log entries, so you can be alerted about things.
Yeah. So where do you normally find them? Like in the var directory or something?
Yeah, /var /log. Mm-hmm. And you can generally, with the ls commands, I mean, I don't know how much you want to go into commands, because it's not, I don't know how friendly that is to the listener, but with the ls command, you can basically list the thing that was written to last, or the newest file. And so if something's, you know, going wrong and lots of information is being written to it, that'll be the last thing it was written to. So you can use that. Lots of tricks. It all kind of, it becomes muscle memory after a while. You know, you just type things.
Is there a tail command you can use as well to, like, if
there is. You can use tail -F and then your log. And that will follow the log as it's being written, sort of thing, at your terminal. But I tend to use the less command. The less is a pager where you say less this file, and then it prints out the file and you can go up and down.
Yeah.
But there's a key combination is F, and it will follow like tail -F.
Okay, cool.
But then you can go back up,
which is
handy. Or you can search for previous log entries or whatever.
Because I must admit, since I've been back from OddCamp, I have been getting into using VI quite a lot now and using all the commands and stuff. I've printed myself out a print sheet, and it's on my wall next to me.
Oh. Right.
So, I still don't know
a lot of stuff about VI. I'm still, you know, I still find the key combination every once in a while is really useful. That could have done with for the last 5 years. no, it didn't. Again, that's a lot of that's muscle memory, you know. Colon WQ becomes second nature after a while.
Yeah, so, yeah, okay, cool. We were talking about those log files, and last episode I was talking about a distribution about Linux, which is basically, I can't remember what it's called now.
Is it OM Distro?
Yeah.
I've
got that working. It took me about 2 hours to install and working. Within right. 2 hours, I managed to get it working, and now I've got it monitoring all my home servers and my remote servers, including cool. Windows, Linux boxes, my VPSs and stuff. So, yeah, I'm really impressed with that. I mean, I was showing Andy, wasn't I, the other night.
Yes.
It's for ease, it's really good. And I need to look at how it actually kind of... Because you basically install a little agent, it's MK agent kind of thing. And it,
yeah.
I was
looking at that. I was looking at that check MK after you sent me a mail about
yeah.
it. And looks really good. Looks really interesting. I think it's based on Nagios. Nagios is... this sort of monitoring software. It's kind of industry standard monitoring software, and it uses that to do all the checks and so on.
Yeah, I need to make sure really how it works with, like, security-wise, and if it's sending stuff over the network clear or something, or if someone can use it to hack into it, and then if it's only like a read-only process, or is it doing, say, like a read-write process?
Right.
So
I use a Nagios-like thing for my clients, who are running web servers, and I always do it over SSH, so it's always encrypted.
Yeah.
Over the internet.
So are you doing like an SSH channel then? Like yes, would like swapped over keys and stuff, or?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's basically sending a command over SSH. This what I'm doing. But yeah, I'd have to look into CheckMK because I'm not entirely sure. Like you say, I'm not entirely sure how it works. I'm interested in it though, because.
Yeah.
It's the configuration side that it's really painful with Nagios because it's all text files. So
this check stuff's not. It's all we're doing a podcast on it. I need to get myself installing it once again. Then we can come back and then we can talk about it. Really.
Yeah. So. I'm going to have a look at it as well. So we'll compare notes.
So you talk about log files there and stuff. I'm guessing the other thing, like the services, is like in Windows, if something goes wrong, like a SQL server stops, you can start the service. I'm guessing you get the same kind of thing in Linux, don't you?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of Linux machines are servers and they run services. They're called daemons in Linux a lot of the time. They often have D on the end. So can't think of any examples.
HTTPD, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. So... Yeah, so it just means daemon. Not in the. What I heard is in ancient Greek mythology, between the gods and humans, were these things called daemons, and they pass messages between the gods and humans. So, I think that's where the name comes from.
Interesting.
But anyway, these services run, and they generally write to a log file, and that's how you tell what they're doing there's no other sort of visual way of doing it.
Yeah, and then you can stop and start them, can't you, as well, those if you need to?
Yeah, there's, what I'm used to is it's called the sysv in it, which is basically a script which has been written by whoever's done the service, like, say, Apache. They'll provide a script which starts and stops or checks the config. Because a lot of the time, if the service won't start, it's because there's something wrong with the config file, which is how you configure the service.
Yeah.
So you can do all sorts of things like that with them. But there is a new kind of init system around now, which is being done by a guy who works for Red Hat. And it's causing a lot of consternation in the Linux community. It's called systemd. I've only used it once or twice. I mean, I haven't really got any opinions on it as yet. Once I get exposed to it, I might have some some views from the trenches, as it were. So.
Doesn't like init, is it init D or so? So you got system D, and then which is like what there's a new. What there's all this hassle everyone's moaning about it or whatever. Because Debian was like deciding, are we going to go System D? What's the other one called? The init.
SysVinit. It's really kind of ancient. I think it was originally BSD, which is another kind of Unix. That's where it came from originally. But it's nice and simple. It's just scripts. And so you can even write your own init scripts, whereas I think System D is all a bit more, it does a bit more behind the scenes. I don't know if you want me to go into the init system. It could turn into quite a dull podcast. You might lose a few listeners.
But System D, doesn't it, like init system, that does it loads one process at a time, doesn't it? So it's one after the other, isn't it? Whereas System D, I think you can run multiple instances at once or multiple services at once.
I think you basically, with System D, you say this system needs to start, and for this process to start, it needs these other processes, or it depends on this, and other things depend on this.
Mm-hmm.
So you just chuck everything at it and then it works out for itself. But then you lose the kind of control then that you used to have. And it goes away from this Unix philosophy of having little things doing individual things and working together in that way. System D kind of takes over everything.
Yeah.
I think that's what people are upset about. But I'm not particularly upset. Let's just see if it works or not. How much of a pain in the arse it is to administer.
Yeah. Okay, that's cool. So, have you got anything else? I was just wondering, anything else we can... Do you think like adding users and stuff? With your Linux box, Because like with an AD, Windows and my server, you add them all into one domain or whatever, If I can log on to a server and it will just let me log on with that one user account. Do you get the same sort of thing in Linux?
There are similar things in Linux, but I don't think it's ever been cracked in the same way that it has with AD. Although AD uses the back end, I think, is LDAP.
Yes, correct.
Or behind the scenes, and that does exist in Linux. Mm-hmm. I haven't had much exposure to it. A lot of the time with Linux boxes, the way people use them these days is on the web, and users are individual to each box, but to kind of synchronize all that, you use configuration management, which is a whole separate topic. It's kind of a bit more, that's why I'm quite interested in at the moment, sort of centralized configuration management, which I believe is similar to something like SCCM in Windows.
Yeah.
People might have heard of Puppet. What I'm using is Ansible. And that's how I add users now to my client's boxes, for instance, and my own server. That's the way I'd go.
So is that like a thing, like a bit of like, is it like, so you put in a, you install an application on the host, on your host you want to control, and then from one central place, you can edit a config file, and then does it push those?
Well, the way Puppet works is it's got an agent on each box, and you have a master, and then the agents talk back to the master, kind of ask the master how they are supposed to be configured.
Yeah.
And then they get their configuration, and they configure themselves, and the agent sorts out all the sort of system calls, all the sort of low-level stuff.
Yeah.
The way that Ansible works is the other way around. It all works through SSH. You don't need anything installed on the sort of client. It pushes it all through SSH and does it all through SSH. It's a lot simpler, and you don't need any configuration on the clients.
So like you want to add a user, would you type the user command in on your PC, and then it pushes that all in Ansible, and then that Ansible then pushes it out? Is that what you're saying, Kyle?
Similar. You have a user module, and you say name the user, the groups that they want to be in, or that you want them to be in, what shell they're running, just like that. So you can, and then you can apply that to, the power of it is you can then apply it to multiple boxes.
Yeah.
And keep everything in sync that way. Because and to me, that's a lot easier than setting up LDAP or the other one's NIST, which has got really big security problems, and you wouldn't want to run it over the internet. So
no, I was just thinking, like, if you're working for a company and you had to have everyone has their own logon for it, I don't know how that kind of work kind of thing. I think if you have like 100 servers and you've got like 10 admins or whatever, then you want to add in, I'm guessing you generally use that to add in 10 admins onto all those, because I'm guessing you don't want to give everyone the root password, but I'm guessing that some of the time you might need to have that root password. It's just
the way you do it in Linux is you would give people pseudo privileges so that they can become root using their own password.
Yeah.
And then they can do, you can either do it so they can become root for one command, you can do it so that they can become root, do all the root stuff they need to do, and then become a normal user again. Because it's kind of a golden rule with Unix, you don't want to be root for too long in case you accidentally delete everything.
Yeah, I have a bit of a ghost. One of the guys at work was telling me that, don't know why, but someone decided to, because in the Linux file system, it's because that's what really confused me when I first came from Windows to Linux, is that the file system, because obviously I'm just used to like a C and a D drive, everything is from the root file system, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I think Windows, at least it used to have this concept, because I when I was looking into disk software RAID and stuff, really sort of Windows 2000 server era.
Yeah.
There's this concept of mount points in Windows.
You still get them in a couple of my clients, like using them for SQL servers. They like having their mount points. So you basically, what it means is, if you have a new hard drive in Windows, is you can put that into your server or whatever, and instead of formatting it and giving it a name, like a C drive or a D or an E drive, you can tell it to mount it to something else. So like so you have a folder on your C drive called data, and if you get and you mount that hard drive into that data folder.
Yeah, I mean it's that's exactly the same concept as Unix uses. It's just a different way of looking at things. In Unix or Linux at least, everything is a file. Including your mounted drives, your processor, the devices that are attached to your system, they're all files. So they're all part of the file system. That's just the way Unix is.
Yeah, because
was written.
Going back to it, the thing is about running as root. Someone mounted a partition, some remote server into the temp directory. Don't ask me why. And then someone decided to go in and delete the temp directory because they're running out of space on the server, and then because it's mounted in the temp directory, it obviously went through and deleted all the thing in the temp, and it deleted everything in this mounted on the server. Ooh, you know,
that sounds like a bit of a horror story. I've got my own horror story, but I won't go into it. I still wake up in the middle of the night sometimes.
Yeah. So, all right. Cool. Okay, that's really interesting. We had a couple of emails in, haven't we, Andy?
We certainly have.
After my plea from last week saying, is anyone listening?
We put a plea out to say, are we alone? Is there anybody out there? It's like we're sending a message to another planet or something. Anyway, someone from another planet. Actually, it wasn't another planet. I think it was New Zealand, wasn't it?
It's about as far away as you can get on this planet.
We did. I've got the email here. I'll read it out. Right. So it's from Chris from New Zealand. And he says, hi, guys. A short note of support of your show. I've listened to every episode and look forward to many more. The key is keeping it raw and unscripted conversation between two techs. You are definitely not talking to yourselves. So that's great. Keep up the good work. So thanks, Chris, for that email. At least we know we're not just talking to no one. And you know, at least somebody's picking up on all of the info that we're giving out there.
Yeah. We haven't had some from our friend of this show, the other Al. He's been doing his Office 365 migration. He's had a couple of issues. Been helping him out with the people he's working for. Looks like they've got have a massive email. They do everything through email folders. So every client's got an email folder. So they've got thousands and thousands of emails. And they've got one email address they use. I think it's admin at whatever the company's called. And they have read over that he had over like 30 gigs worth of mail in this one mailbox. And I think they're actually, everything was stored on Firebird. Or is it not Firebird? What's it called? Is it Firebird, the open source email client?
Thunderbird, is it?
Thunderbird, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And there isn't a straightforward tool to get from Thunderbird into Outlook to get the stuff into Office 365.
So, oh, right, to convert it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can't think of the details.
Can you not use IMAP for that?
He'd already done, all the mail had been downloaded directly into this offline, into his Thunderbird. So he had to purchase this tool, which basically did it. And so he managed to get it onto a PST file. But the problem he had is it was a shared mailbox. And every time he imported it, it'd get halfway through and then crash. But I think we finally worked out that there's only a 10 gig limit on the shared mailbox. So he had to make this mailbox into a actual mailbox. Because you actually get a 50 gig limit on the mailbox. So he did this. And then he emailed us in that he wanted some help just getting it the last bits over. And it says, he said, I've got all the email accounts all changed over and the email properly imported and the folder structure is now perfect for the customer. The admin mailbox, the company mailbox, is now set up as a standard, Office 365 account instead of a shared mailbox. The last thing I need to do is allow two other users to get the access into Outlook 2013 to receive these emailed and send as the admin if they need to. I've done some searching, can only find with reference to a PowerShell admin for some reason. I can't get connected via PowerShell. I may be missing a step, but can I do this via the admin portal or the local admin account with delegation access, or will this have to be done in PowerShell? Cheers, Al. Right, so he needs to share this AbNaba mailbox out to the other people in the company. You can do this if you want to give everyone full mailbox access. You need to go to the ECP page, which I'll put a link in the show notes, and that's basically the Exchange Control Panel. And if you go in there, you can then click on the mailbox, which you give full access permissions. You can click on that and then you can add the permissions in that way. And you can also go in there, pardon me, and you can go in there and you can add to send as permissions. Okay, so once you've done that, you can then go into Outlook and you can go and add that mailbox as a second mailbox. So if you go into, I can't remember what it is at the top, put the show links in show notes, but you can go in there, go in File Options, Account Settings, click on the Exchange account, then you can click on the second tab along, and I think you can then add in the next mailbox. But I'll put all that in the show notes. You can do delegation access as well, as basically that means that you can only give people certain access to certain. So it's quite good if you want to give someone just access to your calendar, you can delegate access in the calendar and actually send the other user an email to do that. So he was talking about PowerShell as well. You can do a lot of the ECP stuff or a lot of the stuff in Exchange in 2012 now. Microsoft doing everything by the PowerShell first and then putting a GUI on top of it. So you have to download a PowerShell commandlet onto your PC. I think you have to have .NET 4.5 installed on your PC. And then you install this PowerShell commandlet, and then you type in a couple of commands, and it will ask you for your username and password, and then you can go into the PowerShell command, and then you can do all the commands you need to do all the bits and bobs you need to by the PowerShell to do things in Office 365. So hopefully that helps them out. I'll put the links in the show notes. I'll give them a couple of links in the, I've emailed him some links, so I'll put them in the show notes so that we can get that. And yeah,
I've had one situation in the past, and I can't remember all the details off the top of my head, where somebody's done something similar, but not, wasn't Exchange involved. It was just the Thunderbird. I think they were downloaded on Thunderbird via POP, and then they were running out on Outlook and wanted all their emails converted over.
Yeah.
And I can't remember. I know that we'd done it eventually, but I can't remember how. But I can see his predicament there. I mean, it sounds like a bit of a dilemma in one respect, but hopefully he should be all right with that.
Yeah. Cool. All right, well, I think we're just at the end of the show now. So again, if you want to email us in again to say you're listening, that would be great. No, we're not talking out into the black world out there. Have you got anything else to say, Joe, before we go?
Just great to be on the show, and I hope we can do it again sometime.
Well, I've got one quick one that people might be interested in doing. So this is to Jerry, really. If anyone's out there who's never used any kind of Linux before whatsoever, what would you suggest to them to kind of get started and start to learn about it?
Well, I have given friends of mine who gave me their dead laptops, Ubuntu, excuse me, and they haven't had any complaints. I have only really used Ubuntu on the desktop. I've used quite a few others just on the command line, but Ubuntu seems pretty friendly. There may be others. There's loads out there, so probably, you know, other podcasts, other sort of speciality Linux podcasts would have more information on that side of things.
Yeah, there's other ones. There's one called Puppy Linux as well, isn't there?
Linux,
I've heard of Ubuntu,
Mint is one that I've heard of. It's based on Ubuntu. It's got a nice sort of desktop.
What if there was any techs out there who had never used Linux but wanted to start up on it and start learning any command lines? What would you suggest for that? Or is there any good resources out there?
The one that I used, and it's been a fair few years now, I started out using Red Hat, or Red Hat-based ones, but I didn't learn much. And then I used one called Gentoo, where you have to build it basically from scratch. And that taught me so much about what was going on underneath. That was what really got me into actually wanting to do it for a living. So I say Gentoo. I think the modern sort of equivalent is Arch, which I haven't actually tried. I might be trying that soon on a PC I've got at home. So I'd say if you're an admin and you really want to learn what's going on, Gentoo or Arch.
Okay, so that sounds good. Yep. I'm one of those who wants to learn what's going on.
Okay, we'll give it a go. I'll be happy to answer any questions if I can. But it's been a while, like I say. So.
Okay.
But you can download download Ubuntu, can't you, and put it onto a USB stick or burn it to burn a live ISO image, can't you?
Yeah.
And then you can then boot the PC up, and then you can, without harming any of your machine, you can boot it up.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. You can do that with a lot of Linux distributions. Unless they're trying to save space on the image, I think they'll often do a live CD or live USB just by default. So, yeah, good way
you
to
could
try
also,
it.
Yeah, you could. Yeah, I've done it that way. I mean, you could also use a virtual machine, couldn't you, as well, on your desktop?
Yeah, yeah.
I've done that before as well, I think. You know, just get the ISO image for Ubuntu, for example. And if you don't want to install it onto a hard drive or anything like that, just run it as you can run it as partition, can't you? Ubuntu, you can put Windows and Ubuntu. Yeah,
you can dual boot. Run it as a VM. The advantage of a VM is if you screw it up and you've been using snapshots, that could be quite handy. But it's not. Yeah, sometimes it's useful to have just a VM there. So even if you just want to sort of do something to a file that you can only do in Linux, you just have like a shared drive, like a Samba. Samba's a whole different whole chapter. The same will come to the end of the show, but basically file sharing between Windows and Linux.
I've run it before for getting whenever a hard drive off a machine, off a, say a laptop or tower that doesn't boot or whatever, and I've got to try and recover the data off it. I know some of the times with the issues of Windows permissions and things like that.
Yeah.
I've actually run up a Ubuntu image and then plugged the Windows hard drive into that machine and then copied it to another NAS drive somewhere, and it just ignores the permissions.
I mean, that's in my day when I was doing that kind of thing, you couldn't mount NTFS drives, but that's all been sorted out now. So
I have a Linux box, a Linux VM on my work machine because I boot up, because I can do things like dig and stuff, because you don't get the dig command, which basically it pulls information from DNS records. So it's quite handy to have things like that. I have a VM with running, I run Ubuntu or Zubuntu.
Right. Well, if you're doing that, you don't necessarily need a GUI. You can just SSH into it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that. If I'm irony of ironies, I'm actually doing this on a Windows laptop. That's what my day job's provided me with. I've got a feeling it was easier to set the microphone up and stuff on this Windows laptop.
Well, I'm running this on my Linux box now, and it's fine. It just plugged the Samsung one. It just plugged in and found it straight away. So.
Right. I've got the Linux box I've got upstairs where I'm doing this is slightly older hardware, so
yeah,
I think I've had a few issues with it in the past. But yeah, I mean, I always SSH into boxes that I'm administering. So just PuTTY or Super PuTTY lets you have tabs.
Super PuTTY, haven't heard of that.
Yeah, it just gives you tabs along the top.
Yeah.
So which I've always. Because I always had loads of PuTTY windows open, and now they're neatly arranged, so that's handy. I'm thinking of putting. I've got a spare partition on this laptop, which I keep meaning to put Linux on, but it's just finding the time, isn't it? You know, just
cool.
Too busy work doing actual work to play around with Linux.
Thank you for coming on the show.
No worries, you're welcome.
So. Right, so again, we've got the Google Plus page. Come and like us on that page. Add us to your circle. We can find the information about... There might even be a competition next week on the next show, which we'll have more detail. So you can listen to the next show and we'll have some more info on that. So have you got anything else to say, Andy?
No, it's been a good show. Yeah, thanks for coming on. It's been interesting, and I'm certainly trying to get more involved in a bit of Linux stuff, not particularly from my job or what I need to do or anything. It's just for my own needs, I suppose.
Yeah,
it's just handy to know. It's handy to be aware of everything, isn't it? Yeah,
it's all relevant, you know, whether it's Linux or Windows. It's, you know, it's the same thing, just done in a different way. And if you learn how things are done in a different way, it gives you a better understanding of it in the first place. So, yeah.
Cool. All right. Well, if you want to email us, you can email us at mail@adminadminpodcast.co.uk. So we'll speak to you all soon, guys.
Okay. See you now. Bye now.